First of all, we've had the opportunity to read through the submissions. We apologise for not being voted.
Thank you. Well, I have prepared a summary that I assume you don't really just go.
If you just want to hit the high points, that's fine. Yes.
So that's if I start at paragraph 10 of it, and the preceding paragraphs I just introduced the Hill explained that they own the Hill's golf course and adjacent land, and that the golf course is an example of an activity which sits well within the rural landscape, even though it isn't a traditional rural use.
Interrupt you momentarily there. The question I have is, is there an argument that the Hills sits well in the rural landscape because it's out of the back seat? I have an interest in golf because I'm a particularly poor quality golfer, and I've driven those roads round the hills and discovered that all you can see is the fence. So, hence my question.
Well, I think that concurrence there is relevant to the extent that it shows that Japan has these other types of rural activities in the world, non-traditional rural activities, but the activities in the rural landscape, and I think that well within it, that that is sort of the rise from the adverse effects.
And similarly, having stood on the Coronet Peak car park, tried to figure out where the hills was and failed, and similarly tried to see it from the top of the zigzag, presumably you would say it wouldn't fall foul of the policies about protection of views either, because it's very difficult to discern from the higher vantage points.
Yes. In terms of its current development, that's right. And it isn't my favourite, it's about standing up for one step.
Thank you.
So starting at paragraph 10 then of my summary, where I just really set out the number of Project Helmets submissions on chapters 3 and 6. It's concerned to ensure that appropriate recognition is afforded to provision made for non-traditional non-farming land uses in rural landscapes, noting numerous activities, golf being one, which have been legitimately established in and have shaped these landscapes and contributed to its development, and which for function and other reasons require a rural location. These activities, many of which are associated with tourism, tend to be significant employers in and drawcards for the district and contribute to its attraction to tourists. They are therefore enabling of people's and communities' economic and social well-being, and accordingly, should be recognised and provided for in higher order objectives and policies of the proposed plan. Trojan Harmon is also concerned to ensure that a rural landscape subdivision use and development is not preferred, provided any adverse effects, particularly on landscape character and visual unity, are appropriately avoided, remedied, or mitigated. Noting that, unlike ONL's and ONS, protection of such landscapes is not mandated by the Act, and there are parts of the rural landscape that can absorb food development. It is also concerned to ensure that the wording of the proposed plan is carefully considered, given the words being what they say, and that clarification is provided that Chapter 6 only applies to the rules. Shows you how much considers the proposed plan is currently weighted too far in the direction of protecting all landscapes, which may frustrate legitimate development proposals, and fails to recognise that lawfully established activities currently exist and operate within these landscapes. Further, it overemphasises that in accordance with traditional farming activities, there are other activities that require rural locations, golf courses, and also rural lifestyle uses, which may better provide for the economic well-being of landowners and to the wider community. Trojan's Helmets submission is supported by the Otago, the Operative Regional Policy Statement and the Proposed Regional Policy Statement as well, which respectively must be the proposed one must give effect to and have regard to. And there I've set out the provisions of those statements, which I think are important and which haven't been addressed or considered in the Section 32 evaluations or in the Section 32A officer reports when assessing the proposed plan under those high-risk documents.
Ms. Wong, the question for you, looking at the proposed RPS, the functional need to locate rural areas, my experience is that golf courses are variously located in urban areas. We can see over the top of Queensland Park and Seaway, out on Point, or Wanaka, or Cromwell, and in rural areas, like Queenside. So it's not focusing just on your client's golf course. There's, of course, the Arrowtown Golf Course, which is part of is outside the Arrowtown urban boundary. Do you think you can make out the case that golf courses have a functional need to locate in rural areas?
I think in this district, yes. Given the housing shortage and the need to focus on addressing that within the urban growth boundaries, within the plan that is identified as appropriate for residential uses. I think that it is inevitable that land, such as golf courses, will be taken up in time by urban development. Certainly the golf course at Frankton is not going to the golf course forever. It's not going to be used for housing development, but it's on land. Jack's Point is only in the urban growth boundary as a result of the proposed ban. Previously it's on special zone, but it's within the rural landscape or environment, I think, as you look at it. So I think there is something to see that if they can't go on rural landscapes, they're quite limited.
Just knowing that, in fact, your client wants rather more than golf course there, can residential development, albeit of low density, or similar sort of development be considered to have a functional need to locate in the rural areas?
In terms of
that
aspect of my client, I think that is for designing which will mean that successful is a policy. Oh, they want to apply. Sorry, well, of course, Chapter 3 on to some extent, but Chapter 6 on May, but the land will no longer be zoned rural.
Well, isn't then the intention of your submission at this point to ensure that the high order gets some policies, set a framework that will enable us to agree with your future rezoning? Is that the point of it?
Well, that's too far away to say. That's the same as the design
a lot of things that are names put on the zone. We have urban land, we have rural land.
Yes, well, it's not within the urban growth boundary, but I don't consider it urban development in the sense it's low density, it's great for the landscape, that well, it's effectively a rural lifestyle density, approximately 30 hectares.
So that,
130 hectares across the site.
So that brings me back to this policy in the proposed RPS. Is there a functional need for that sort of development to be in a rural area?
Yes,
there
is.
As well, could you help me in terms of the, just going back to paragraph 10A there, where it talks about numerous activities. You've identified golf courses there. Could you have other activities that you had in mind that should be included in?
My client is primarily focused on golf courses, but also ensuring that certain areas need to be included are not necessarily included.
But the numerous, your clients, are you asking for numerous activities or just for the activities in regard to your clients?
Well, the changes to the provisions in order to provide the uses such as golf courses are addressed by Mr. Brown, and because it's with high level objectives and policies, they're addressed in a high level way. So it's not, my client is not seeking Mr. Brown's evidence, seek to provide specific exceptions or make provisions for specific activities. It's ensuring that the high level provisions are framed in a way where these uses are included, and protection of this rural landscape is not achieved at any cost. And there are other legitimate uses of that land which have significant economic and social benefits.
But would, if we were looking at this, would it follow that we would be looking at the provisions or those that would apply to all golf courses across the district?
Sorry.
If the strategic provisions are written in such a way that it allows for what you've said your client seeking, then it would equally apply to all golf courses or other activities such as that across the entire district?
Only to the extent that, as Mr. Brown's going to address, the effects can be appropriately managed. You know, it's not a matter of right provision. It's seeking a focus on managing effects within rural landscapes that are coming out and on you, as opposed to outright protection or provisions which are very much directed towards protection, which is the position in the closing.
Commissioner Sinclair is alluding to and worrying me as well, is whether your submission and Mr. Brown's evidence and several other pieces of evidence are trying to shape the district, the entire district plan, to suit the Wakatipu Basin. Is that? And is that really the way we should look at it? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering whether the entire district plan should be designed to suit the Wakatipu Basin, or whether the Wakatipu Basin part of the district plan should be designed to suit the Wakatipu Basin.
Yes, I think that's right. And I the difficulty arises here with the one size fits all approach, which is the approach they have in the proposed plan is notified. And I don't see any issues with having a more focused approach on particular parts of the district. If it means that if there are particular issues that require a particular management response, different management response in each of those different parts, it seems that there would be a focus in the proposed plan on short and just pure pages of principles, and so it's a very organized approach, and I don't think that it's a founded in section 32. I think the intent is ensuring that if the issues are appropriately produced, that requires a different approach to the property basin, then that might be a nice submission that's been provided.
You're saying that across rural as well as on
saying
there should be a split from rural water to rural.
No, I'm saying I can't assist you on that because my client's submission doesn't concern on our
land. I rural.
It's just rural landscapes, yes.
So, just going back though, if your client is only concerned about in the water to be basin, is that really what your submission is focused on? Is how the objectives and policies apply to activities in the water to be basin?
Well, that's what my client's position is focused on, but the grounding was takes it a wider
scope. Well, I was just at the present moment as well, although I'm not sure that it does get it right in the water to be basin either.
Well, yes, it does. I'm not across all the but yes, in a nutshell, my client is concerned with human rights to be able to be based on the expert. And when Mr. Brown, his expert opinion is how he thinks that should be done appropriately.
I think that is to the answer you gave to an earlier question. Says, are of the nature and scale compatible with rural activities? Do you think that's a reverse sensitivity reference? Or is it broader? Is it compatible with the rural environment?
I would bring that.
Then that would be a strong pointer that it should be, if not enabled, at least allowed. Thank you.
So before we move off the RPS provisions there, those are just generally the way out. RPS has been high-level documents. Are there any provisions within the operative or proposed one that probably almost say exactly the opposite in terms of what's in here in terms of, I don't know, protecting landscape, or even though it might be in the rural area and it's not an O&L?
I couldn't ask that without referring to documents, but certainly the both those documents are fairly drafted in a flexible way, and the language used quite loose and not particularly directive as to outcomes. So, but when I looked at when I reviewed the offered and proposed regional policy statement, there was nothing that stood out to me as being in conflict with these policies. If that's what you were.
Just a key. Just while we're talking about the outcomes, you referred to the proposed policy for I presume on your submission there that you consider we can give some weight to that audio.
We need to regard to it, obviously.
Yes.
And I set out in my submission in the appendix what that means.
Yes.
I think I can take that.
So, well, the question I was coming to is that any other policies in the proposed ideas should be treated in the same way as we treat that one. But however much weight we give it,
yes,
could be the same.
Yes, that's right. And although I haven't looked at the submissions on the proposed RPs to ascertain how this policy is used, or what it means, if it's used or proposed. So that could be a matter of, I think, relevant to your consideration.
Yes.
This is a challenge. You know, I think we would give a greater weight than those objects and policies that might be subject.
I think we might go out and move on now.
I think
you can
go on. I think I want to clear out the summarise the statutory framework, and I'm sure you would have read this is similar to what I've seen on other professions I've got by the clients, which I take it you've read, based on the questions that I've got to Mr. Winchester and others. So I will go through actually the broad principles. You do not start with any particular production as the appropriate zone policy rule or objective. No owner lies with a submitter to establish that subject provisions should be deleted in order for a production of the provisions of the proposed plan approved for subject. These proceedings are more in the nature of an inquiry into the merits, according to the Act's central objectives and the existence of the your task is to seek to obtain the optimum planning solution from the scope of the matters reported based on an evaluation of the totality of the evidence without imposing a burden of proof on any party. You need to do so within the third paragraph of Part 2. Section 32, in terms of what most appropriate, the High Court has said that appropriate means suitable. You don't need to be satisfied that the method is inferior.
Can I just stop you there and invite you to explain to me what you think His Honour Justice Gendall's decision actually means in that regard, because I have to confess I find it utterly impenetrable having said that appropriate means suitable, that would suggest most appropriate means most suitable, how that doesn't mean superior. The logic just escapes me.
Yes, it is I have read that paragraph of the decision quite current, just trying to retain precisely what it means. Certainly, subsequently, it has been interpreted in a way after that year, but you just need to be satisfied that it's probably suitable. And when you read the regulation transport case, it doesn't actually require you to presuppose suitable with most. It actually, I think, reads as most appropriate means suitable, and there are some difficulties, I think, with that. But that's what the High Court judgment says.
Is the reality that we don't know what it means, but it says what it says?
To some extent. I think I guess that's one aspect of one factor that you need to consider when undertaking your overall evaluation. And you don't need to be necessarily concerned with ensuring that you choose the best option. You just need to be satisfied that it's a suitable option and that it meets all those other tests as well. So G, the words most appropriate. Section 32 allow ample room for the council or its officers to report that it considers one approach as appropriate and for the decision maker to take an entirely different view on the basis of the accepted evidence and the information it has received. And that's consistent with what I've earlier said earlier, that there's no presumption that the proposed plan is notified as correct or appropriate. And H, and I understand that Commissioner Gilmore was particularly interested in this submission, that in Section 32 is there primarily to ensure that any restrictions on the complete freedom to develop are justified rather than the converse. It is the nose of the plan which must be justified, not the eyes. And this accords my submission to the policy direction of Section 9, which is that the use of land is permitted unless the district rule says otherwise, and also the act of enabling purpose.
Can I take that up, get in front of Commissioner Gilbert?
He always does this. I can't really go to question any Johnson.
I had a look at the case authority that you cited for that proposition, and it seemed to me to be no better than an indication of view. Judge Skelton specifically said he wasn't making a final finding, he was just attracted to that reasoning. Mm. Is there any more recent case authority?
No, there's not. And look, to be fair, that's correct. The evidence of the planner at the time, which I think when you read the decision, it's cited with approval in that judgment. But that's as far as it goes.
And I suppose the other proposition I should put to you is Section 32 doesn't say it's limited, does it? It applies to all provisions, mm-hmm. both enabling and restrictive.
Yes. Yes, that's right. But my submission here is no, sorry.
So do both answers, from what I understand, even two answers, suggest that your age is rather more qualified than it's stated?
Yes.
So you maybe not be that just fine. Thank you.
Well, I think it's helpful nonetheless to focus your inquiry. Bear in mind Section 39 consumption, policy approach that you are that the agency has been able to otherwise, and I think these people need to be satisfied that a restrictive approach or a disabling approach of the rules of policy is justified.
That is, however, quite different from your first sentence, which says Section 32 is there primarily to ensure that any restrictions on the complete freedom to develop are justified. I think that's a very different.
Well, I don't know if it's very different, but if it is more qualified, yes. I did anticipate any questions on that submission. So, in conclusion, the proposed plan must, in the purpose of the year, strike an appropriate balance between all relevant resource management relating to the use, development and protection of the district's natural resources. And and on my submission and in the evidence in Mr. Rao's evidence, as notified, including with the section for the play reporting officer's recommended amendment, the proposed plan is weighted too far under the protection of all landscapes, and this will frustrate the development proposals. Should add that into the rural landscape. My submission overemphasizes the importance of farming activities. Other activities that require a rural location, such as rural residential and rural lifestyle uses and golf courses, for example, may better provide for the economic well-being of landowners and the wider community in the face of rapid growth, and therefore should also be enabled, or at least recognised, depending on the location and management of potential adverse effects on the landscape and our values. I won't read that last sentence out in the discussion that we just had about the location of golf courses. My submission, a district plan regime that balances protection and the use and development of all resources taking into account section 6 and 7 manners are not replacing them is the most appropriate regime to achieve the objectives of the Act. And I address in my legal submissions, which you have just read over the break, I address the
just referring to your legal submissions, in paragraph 42, you talk about the implications of King Salmon. And in subparagraph C, you talk about considering high order documents. The way you put it, the second way, the extent of the policies or higher must be given effect unless there is a conflict. To what extent, given your earlier comments about the general nature of the operative RPS, do we just look straight through that at part two?
Do you look
To what extent should we look through the operative RPS to R2, to part 2?
I don't think you can bypass the operative RPS. You still need to give effect to the provisions of it. But you may be enough, given the provisions of that document pretty broadly drafted.
Following up on that, were actually two questions. My recollection is that the exceptions, there are all exceptions that you've stated, several quarters, one about if you form the view that the higher order plan is not consistent with part two. But taking your answer as given, if the RPS gives a number of choices, a wide latitude, as you call it, I think one of the biggest features is words, but I think you know what it means. Would it be legitimate to look back to part two to get guidance as to which of the of a number of options in the spectrum might be more appropriate, more suitable? Going back to paragraph 6, you make this comment at least twice, talking about about the inevitability of growth, which harkens back to the discussion we were having with Mr. Goldsmith before you commenced your submissions, that is growth necessarily inevitable? Is it necessarily inevitable that this plan must provide for growth if growth comes at an unacceptable environmental cost?
Brown addresses this policy, but I think that it's right, it's clearly an issue that's facing this district, and I don't think putting the human sand to deal with it anyway, in terms of it needs to be dealt with in some way.
But saying there should be no more, as our town has done with the implementer of the environment court, will no more beyond the existing urban limits, which don't provide, I think Mr. Goldsmith said, provided for 5 years into the future, was a legitimate response. Mm. Do you agree with that?
I think it can be, provided the evidence is in that analysis undertaken before the project.
Of background. What was the basis on which the Hills Golf was going to residential use? Are there conditions around residential use? Like, can you give us a sense of what was it that was conceded?
Good question. That was something that I was going to see over the later hearings. But from memory and I don't think it's right. Although I'm saying that there are some of the individual dwellings on the property, but the golf course itself was, the resource consent was for the golf course and the clubhouse, and subsequent consents have come along for the tournaments and the activities associated with those.
So was it tournaments? Did you?
Yes.
Yes.
Such as the New Zealand Open that started, they finished Sunday.
Yes, I believe that consent that engineer sought on a one-off basis for 3 years, and then more recently that has been applied on a grant for that activity to be run annually on an online basis.
In relation to your point of summarising paragraph 20, saying that clarification should be provided in chapter 6 only applies to rural design, I asked Mr. Goldsmith a question as to whether it would be in English the appropriate response for chapter 6 to be clear as to what, if any, outside
the building site. So I think that would be helpful. Because at the moment, if anyone is, and I think an applicant, well, has no idea what's the worst, which is Chapter 6, and then he doesn't have
In terms of question as to whether we use RMA language or words of our own invention,
choice.
Well, we might do us some invention as well. That the question I have for you is you've given us a lot of helpful guidance as to authorities on the meaning of these key terms. My recollection of cases around offsetting is that mitigation is defined by cases of Bathurst Mine, just as one of these decisions, which may have escaped me, said that mitigation means lessening the effect of this building. that called it rural extension? Offsets or mitigation or compensation. But put that very academic. But put that to one side. I think the concern I expressed to Mr. Goldsmith, I want to put the same proposition to you, to be fair, is that to refer to mitigation without being clear as to how much mitigation or what the desired end result is inherently uncertain. So if you disagree, please tell me.
I think that's right to an extent, but it may be that you get down to the lower revisions and that tells you what mitigation is appropriate or required to reduce the effect. But the higher revisions are using the words ordinary and mitigated, something similar. They're not closing the door to that development in the first place.
Thank you for that. Another question for you, also posed to Mr. Winchester, give you the opportunity to comment on in reverse. This relates to your paragraph 42B. The question I ask Mr. Winchester, having read that same proposition in your submissions for Queenstown Airport, whether he was aware of that being stated anywhere in King Salmon, and he said he wasn't, but there was an argument that could be made, it was a logical inference. First of all, can you point to me where that's stated in King Salmon, other than in the dissenting judgment?
No, it's not, and I agree with Mr. Winchester's response in that regard. I think it's the correct one there. No, it's not expressed stated in the decision. I think it can be logically inferred. And as Mr. Winchester said, if it doesn't mean that, then the question arises as to what other activity state, how else would you avoid something? What other activity status would achieve that outcome?
One answer might be Mr. Goldsmith's, that under the ODP there is a fully discretionary regime that is in practice more onerous and more difficult to surmount than a non-complying utility. Would you disagree with that? Would that still meet the logical inference from King Salmon?
I guess it depends on how the provisions of the OPTA and the claim. If it is a void per se, then no, I don't think a discretionary ASAP regime would achieve that. But if it's a void subject to adverse effects, or if it's a void adverse effects, then a discretionary complex discretionary regime could achieve that if you're dealing with the effects. Which probably wasn't a very clear answer.
Just asking the question another way. Is there anything in the Act that suggests that consent for a non-complying activity is, by its fact that it's under Section 104D, more onerous than consent for a discretionary activity?
I don't know if there's anything in the Act other than the set of different tests and then to have a...
There's only one different test, that's Section 104D.
Yes, contrary to the duties of policy, so you need to consider. But the case law is that non-compliant activities, they're an exception. They consent is typically a grounds of an exceptional circumstances. Whereas discretionary activities, the presumption is that they are appropriate, subject to effects being...
Where does it say that in the Act?
No, that's the case. That's the environment court judgments and particular interpretation. That's what it is. And I can't refer you to any cases, sorry. But that is a, as far as I'm aware, that's a, an approach that has been widely taken by the environment court.
Paragraph 48. Bearing in mind the previous discussion about the ambit of section 32, I want to put to you the proposition that the evidence you're calling doesn't provide a quantitative analysis of costs and benefits either, does it?
No, it doesn't.
And in the following paragraph, you're quoting Dr. Reid. I think, to be fair, I need to put to you my understanding of Dr. Reid's evidence, which was that farming, what you describe as farming, is a matter of definition. And if you accept that those rural lifestyle blocks that are running the odd sheep have grass, it's not manicured, as a god would, are farming activities, then there's lots of farming going on within the basin. Now, that's a qualified proposition. Now, as a matter of evidence, do you or your client dispute that? Assuming my characterisation of that evidence is correct.
Mr. Brown touches on that, but what I've set up here is Dr. Reid's responses to questions from the panel in relation to whether or not farming is the predominant activity in the district. And in response to that question, she pointed out existing farms, operational farms, farming units, and they were all located within Owen Mountain. So, and having heard from Mr. Goldsmith that Owen Mountain is comprised 95% of the whereabouts of the district, then I guess, yes, it's fair to say that in the district, predominant farming may be predominant use. But what my client is concerned with is the, not the Owen Mountain of the Owen Mountain, but the rural landscapes. And is it correct to say, and particularly the Washington Basin, is it correct to say that farming is the predominant use in that landscape? And I'm not sure that it is.
Could I just go back to 48, just right at the end there, just regarding those. If they, the costs haven't been provided by either council or that your witnesses either, what implications does that have for us doing the 32AA?
Well, that's a good question. I think where, as far as I can take it, is that comes back to my submission on the Hodge case, which I appreciate you correcting some hot bits. It's the nose that need to be justified, not the eyes. And if you don't have all you need to, all that section 32 requires you to have, you need to be careful about imposing restrictions on the land use. But I appreciate it. It's not helpful for the panel to not have that information at all. And I understand that the council is now undertaking some work in that regard. And the members will have an opportunity to respond to that.
Sorry, I'm trying to pull up the O&R and I can't. I'm just wondering, in terms of Washington Basin, I'm thinking of Chris Dagg's farm, the Bunce farm, the Leeds farm.
Sorry, I'm not
sure. Yeah, so I'm just wondering, Mr. Brown might be able to help me. Are those all on O&R? So I thought they were on Wakatobi Rural. The Bunce, the
aesthetics and the easement. They're all fun, flatland, and there's also others with fun and lease on the process. Not only Tutupuru. Yep, that's one of them.
I'm not sure I can assist you with that, sorry. My submission in paragraph 49 only addresses what Dr. Reed pointed out in terms of where these put on in a time and uses that. But perhaps Mr. Brown can help you with that.
I think it's fair to say that some of those are in the rural landscape.
Yeah, some of them are definitely rural landscapes. It's not all I know. And it's.
That only applies in the Waikato Basin because there are major farms in the rural landscape classification in the Upper Clutha.
Yes, and my submission is focused on
that. Which brings the obvious question. Should that policy be deleted because it is applicable in large parts of the district?
Which policy?
Predominance of the value of farming.
Well, it would depend on what the evidence is about those other parts of the district. But one option to you would be to take a different management approach to the Waikato Basin, recognising that it is different to other parts of the district.
Have any of your submitters actually sought a different management approach for the Waikato Basin other than for their own land?
No, well, my client hasn't, but I think it would be within the scope of your decisions. No. I think it's in terms of the continuum of the relief of the spectrum, I think it sits. The district wide approach is at the far end, and if you have taken a more focused approach, I think that's, I suppose. Further back in towards what is within scope for you to run.
And if you were doing a section 32 on the hop, how would you justify that that you would split those two and apply what I'm assuming is your brief and more permissive regime to Waikato Rural versus Wanaka Rural if you're looking at the old section 5 sustainable management?
Well, that'll be the evidence that you hear throughout the course of these hearings. For example, when you get to the rezoning hearings, if you hear evidence for Hills, for example, you will hear evidence for the rezoning request, but also more detailed evidence as to the activities that are currently undertaken on that land, which are traditional rural land users, and no doubt you hear evidence from a number of other submitters raising similar points in relation to their land and the Waikato Basin. And if you get to the end of that, you think, well, we don't think we should rezone this land, but we have the evidence that actually this isn't used for traditional rural uses, then at that point you might decide that you have sufficient basis upon which to take a different management approach.
One last question, Mr. Lloyd. Talking about openness, the way the policy is framed and focuses on openness in rural landscapes, like not outstanding landscapes, where that's important, and that's the way that Dr. Reed described it. I'm puzzled that you would oppose that, given that part of your case is that you should recognise the different character of what could be basin versus balance of the district, for instance. Presumably, you could go further and recognise the different character within the Waikato Basin. If openness in particular defined areas, or identifiable areas, is an important characteristic, can you explain to me why that wouldn't be a relevant factor?
Well, it may be a relevant factor if the evidence shows that particular cases, but in this case it's a broad brush approach to all rural landscapes in the district. So my submission is that's appropriate.
Isn't the policy asking in future applications for evidence as to whether openness is a factor?